rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
We're counting down to the election, and we're counting down to Saddam's trial wrapping up. Yeah, the White House says they are going to politicize the announcement of Saddam's verdict on Monday. Gee, what a surprise. Anyhow, lots to talk about today, and we're going to get into it. This giant roundup of 11,000 people over the last 2 days, lots of other things. But first, for the first hour of our program, as is the case on every Friday, has been for going on 3 years now, Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent member of Congress, neither a Democrat nor a Republican in the history of the House of Representatives. And he's serving the great state of Vermont. And Bernie Sanders, oh, and our phone number, 866-440-8466, toll free. Bernie loves to take your calls. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com. Hey, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here. How do you see this thing shaping up nationally?
Well, the first thing I want to say, I'll tell you what the pundits are saying. I don't have any more information than I read. But it is terribly important for everybody to understand that the Republican Party, which does not really worry too much about public policy or what happens in government, they do politics very, very well. And what they do an extraordinary job about is making sure that they drag out every last vote that they can. So I would hope that all of the people listening understand that nothing is in the bag, that people are going to have to work very, very hard for the next 4 days. Bring your friends, bring your relatives, get out to the polls, and make sure that we get as big a voter turnout as we possibly can. If not, things will not turn out well. But having said that, what the general punditry analysis is about seems to suggest that everything being equal, and the world could change at a moment's notice, the Democrats stand a very good chance of gaining control over the House. What is amazing to me is that in many safe, what had traditionally been considered to be safe seats, that the Republicans have held for many, many years, they are now being challenged very seriously. In a number of cases, they seem to be falling behind in the polls. So there may be some kind of tsunami of sorts sweeping the country, where people from all walks of life, all regions of this country have said, we have had it with the Bush-Cheney administration, we've had it with one-party government, we've had it with right-wing extremism, and it's time for a change. That appears to be the case. We will see what happens on Tuesday. In the Senate, the situation is not quite so clear. Democrats are doing very, very well. I think the election will probably come down to a few states. Virginia, Tennessee, Missouri are three hotly contested states where the polls have the candidates a few votes apart. In Montana, it's also very, very close. But for the first time now, people are beginning to think that there is a possibility that if things go their way, the Democrats could actually take control of the Senate.
Bernie, conventional wisdom has it, and the talking heads on TV, particularly on cable TV, are suggesting that the thing that is driving this tidal wave is the Iraq war. I respectfully disagree with them, and I'd love to get your take on my take, if you don't mind. When I see the fact, you know, I lived in Vermont for 10 years, and I watched you election after election, I mean, every 2 years running for re-election, and up in the Northeast Kingdom, for example, an area that went heavily for Bush in both of the last two elections, an area that generally is very conservative, you are winning by huge margins. When I look at Montana, Brian Schweitzer, a true progressive, running for governor of a very, very, very red state that went like 70% for Bush, and he wins overwhelmingly, this progressive Democrat. I believe that what's really going on is that people are fed up with voodoo economics, what George Herbert Walker Bush referred to, Reaganomics. The destruction of the middle class is real to them, and there's kind of a news blackout about it. The pundits don't want to talk about it, but this is not something that just happened in the last week.
No, I think you're right, and obviously there are a number of factors. Let us not underestimate the significance of the war in Iraq, where people, I think, increasingly perceive that the president misled them into a war. They were shocked by the lack of preparation for the war. They are dismayed that this president has no plan to bring our troops home. So I think, you know, and every day you pick up the paper, you see television, you think it can't get any worse, and it gets worse. So don't underestimate the significance of the war in Iraq and the horrendous work that Rumsfeld has done in directing that war and so forth and so on. But having said that, I tend to agree with you in the sense that the media certainly underestimates the impact that the destruction of the middle class is having on the political process. You know, you had a president going on television telling us how great the economy is doing, and all that he is really saying is that if you're a millionaire or a billionaire, you're doing very well, and that's true. But I go around this state, Tom, and I talk to whole lots of people, and I always ask them, I say, how are you doing? How is the middle class doing? And, you know, you're looking at a situation where in a rural state like Vermont, people are working two or three jobs, people are losing their pensions, they're losing their health care, they're losing the retirement benefits that were promised to them. Many of the new jobs that are coming into Vermont and all over America are low-wage jobs with poor benefits. You know, the national unemployment statistics do not look too bad. That's true. But if you look at the quality of the jobs that are out there, by and large, they're in the service industry. By and large, the benefits are very poor. What we don't talk about at all is the incredible hours that Americans are now working. I think our people now work, if my memory is correct, the longest hours of any people in the industrialized world.
Right. We beat Japan last year for the first time.
You know, and there was, you know, it used to be in America when we were kids that somebody, one person in a family, could actually work 40 hours a week and earn enough money to take care of the family, right?
Yeah, and take a vacation
every
year.
Take a vacation. Now the two-week vacation is part of ancient American history.
Yep.
So I think you add all of that together, people losing their health care, they're losing their pensions, they're working longer hours for low wages, they can't afford to send their kids to college, the cost of energy is soaring, and people are saying, wait a second, you know, this is not working very, very well for me. This economy is not working very well for me. So I think that's an omnipresent feeling for tens of millions of Americans, and it certainly, certainly has an impact on this election. My hope is, by the way, that the Democrats will move aggressively to make it very clear why the middle class is shrinking, why 5 million more people since Bush has been president have dropped into poverty. Who's talking about that? John Edwards talks about that. A few other people talk about it, but it is certainly not on the front pages of the paper. And the other issue is the growing gap between the rich and the poor. The fact that CEOs now earn 400 times more than their workers make. The fact that we give huge tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires, and then we cut back on federal aid to education. We cut back on the needs of our veterans. We cut back on nutrition programs. Cut back and don't adequately fund special education, which means higher property taxes in Vermont and all over this country. I think it is terribly important that Democrats and progressives focus on those issues and start coming up with real solutions. Obviously, at the very least, we've got to raise the national minimum wage to a living wage. We must, and by the way, unless, you know, depending on what happens on November 7th, I think, Tom, there is a real chance that the new Congress will take a very different attitude toward our disastrous trade agreements than the old Congress has. And I think you're going to see some real questioning about what it means to have a $700-plus billion trade deficit, what it really means to this country when we continue to lose our manufacturing base, what it means to the younger generation if more and more white-collar information technology jobs go abroad, what it means to the future of America if our kids are going to have a lower standard of living than we do. So there are a lot of economic issues out there which have got to be tackled, have got to be articulated, and I think from a public policy point of view, we have to do that. From a political point of view, it's also imperative.
Yeah, two articles in the Wall Street Journal today. One that I'd like to get your take on. One suggested that productivity is flattening out. It looks like corporate America has wrung out of the American worker all they can. And the second pointing out that in Oregon, where I live now, the minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. And that, everybody is surprised that not only did that not hurt Oregon, but actually you've got people who want to move here. And it's actually strengthened the economy of Oregon.
Well, I think, you know, the right wing has always said, oh, my goodness, you know, yes, we want to give tax breaks to billionaires. Yes, we want to make it easier for corporations to throw American workers out on the street and move to China. Oh, no, we can't raise the minimum wage. That will just kill jobs. That will just slow down the economy. The counter-argument to, first of all, there have been a number of studies which have made it very clear that that is not the case. And the second point, I think, is that when you put more income into the pockets of low-wage workers, they're going to take that money and go out and spend it locally and have some economic spin and create jobs unto itself. But the bottom line here is that it is, from almost any perspective, immoral that Americans today, by the millions, are still earning $5.15 an hour in the United States of America. That is not acceptable.
This is the real moral issue.
The moral issue. That's correct.
It's 16 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. We'll be back with your calls right after this. This is the Tom Hartmann radio program, Truth in Broadcasting for a Change in America.
What's wrong with this picture?
Well, let's see. The Republicans are in it. Welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, the real democracy zone. Hey, for our listeners in the Pacific Northwest, the three radio stations in Oregon that carry our program, join me in the End Corporate Personhood Action Group for a pre-election victory party of its satirical candidate for governor of Oregon, Rich Corporate Sun, Inc. Yes, we're running a corporation for governor, just to show corporations really should have the rights of people. It's going to be at 6 p.m. at the Unitarian Church in Portland Saturday night. And admission is $5 to $15. No one turned away at the door. And also on Saturday, November 11th, a week from this weekend, I'll be in San Francisco at the Green Festival on the main stage with a book signing afterwards. It'll be at noon in the San Francisco Concourse Exhibition Center on 8th Street. So just a heads up on events coming up. 22 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. And our number, 1-866-440-8466. Bernie, take some calls.
Let's do it.
Okay, Dan in Louisville, Kentucky. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, honored to talk to you. I know, Tom, that you said that in addition to the Iraq War, we need to consider the economy when deciding our vote for Tuesday. And I wanted to throw into the mix health care. I think, Congressman Sanders, you touched on that briefly. If by some miracle the GOP does not steal at least the House elections next Tuesday, what is on the horizon? I'm paying $900 a month for me and my two kids for health care. And what is on the horizon that might help correct that?
Okay, Dan, there are some very easy solutions. There are some harder solutions. But ultimately, the problem is quite solvable if the Congress has the guts to stand up to the pharmaceutical industry, the insurance companies, and those corporate interests that are making billions off of the health care system. When we talk about health care, Dan, it is important to remember that while 48 million Americans have no health insurance, we spend twice as much per person on health care as do the people of any other country. So it's not that we're not spending enough money. We're spending too much money. It is a system that is incredibly bureaucratic and wasteful. What can we do? First and very easy things that we do, and I would hope that this would be on the top of the Democratic list if they gain control over the Congress. You pass prescription drug reimportation, which essentially means that pharmacists, distributors, and individuals can be able to buy prescription drugs FDA approved so that they're safe from other industrialized countries. You do that, and in 5 minutes, if Americans are paying the same prices for prescription drugs as are paid in Canada or in Europe, you can lower the cost of prescription drugs in this country by between perhaps 25-30%. That would be huge, huge savings. Second of all, in my view, we have got to move as a nation toward a national health care program which guarantees health care to all people. We are wasting tens and tens of billions of dollars through billing, through bureaucracy, through administration, through advertising. Huge savings can be made. Got to do a lot better in terms of disease prevention. One of the easier ways to go forward is for the federal government to say, okay, if a state, Vermont, Kentucky, any other state, are prepared to provide health care to all of their people, the federal government will provide waivers to make it easier to use your federal funds, Medicare, Medicaid, other funds in different ways. We will provide additional funding to you, and you can come up with the universal health care plan that you want. And then I think at the end of a certain period, we're going to look and see which states come up with the most cost-effective ways, and maybe we can do that nationally. But I think that will be a real incentive for each state in this country move as best they can toward universal care. My own preference is a single-payer system. I think that is the easiest, the most cost-effective way to go. Other states may choose a different way. A third thing that I would do is substantially increase funding for community health centers. There is a program called the Federally Qualified Health Center, which provides good quality health care and dental care and mental health counseling and low-cost prescription drugs. We have expanded that program significantly in the state of Vermont, opening up primary health care access to many thousands of Vermonters. If we put more money into that program nationally, quite easily we can solve the problem of primary health care access.
Wow, that's a bunch, and it's brilliant. Scott in Richmond. Scott, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Congressman and Tom, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
The unemployment report that came out today is such a horrendous piece of electioneering propaganda. They adjusted the numbers up. They adjusted them down. They're not using the preferred survey of businesses. They're using home calls with people. They want to count the number of people starting their own businesses and self-employed as if that's a situation by choice. And my
including people
is,
whose business is to sell Tupperware.
Right, they get counted. And my comment is you can't believe a word. I mean, it's kind of a rhetorical comment. You cannot believe a word coming out of this administration.
Well, I think Scott raises a very interesting point, and sometime, Tom, you and I should spend a bit of time on this issue. And that is to determine, in fact, how the official unemployment statistics are determined. Because I think many economists will tell you that they underestimate the reality of unemployment in America because they don't include the chronically unemployed, they don't include people who want to work full-time who are only working part-time, they don't include people who have lost good-paying jobs and obviously are now working at jobs that paid half the wages they used to get. So we've got to do better in coming up with real statistics to show us what is going on for working families.
Yeah, a lot of smoke and mirrors there. 27 minutes past the hour. Brunch with Bernie on the Tom Hartmann Program. And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program talking about freedom. Indeed, talking about freedom 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Right here, 34 minutes past the hour, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders on the line with us, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, our live chat room at tomhartmann.com. By the way, we just updated the software for the chat room, so if you have any difficulty getting in there, you have to download the most recent version of Java. It's free. It's all right there at tomhartmann.com. Just click live chat and get the information. But just a heads up to the folks in our chat room, and a hello to them all. Victor in California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, hi Tom. I love your show.
Thank you,
Bernie. I have just a simple question. Is it naive to think that a flat tax, no matter how much money you make, would solve a lot of our economic woes? If you make $1 million, you pay $100,000. If you make $10 million, you pay $1 million.
Are you talking about income tax or Social Security tax?
I'm sorry, income tax.
No, Victor, I don't think that would be a very good approach. I think the people who are pushing that are very wealthy people, high-income people, and the result of that would mean that high-income people would see a significant reduction in their taxes, while, in fact, many lower-income people would end up paying more. So I think that is not a good approach. I think the approach that we should use and that we have historically used in this country is a progressive income tax, which says that the more income you earn, the higher percentage of your income you should be paying. If people are making $100 million a year, they should be asked to pay a fairly significant amount of that upper income in taxes so that we can have the kind of educational system that we need. So that we do not have to remain dependent on the property tax and other regressive forms of taxes. Today in America, one of the stories that is not talked about terribly much in the media, Victor, is the fact that we have not only the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, but that gap between the rich and the poor and the rich and the middle class is growing wider. What President Bush has done is accelerated that gap, increased that gap by giving huge tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires. So my view is that if we are going to move toward a more egalitarian and fair society, if we're not going to overburden the middle class and working class people with higher and higher taxes, not just federal taxes, but Social Security taxes, state taxes, local taxes like the property taxes, I think you want to move toward a more progressive form of taxation.
And with regard to the Social Security tax, that is a flat tax, although it's capped at $80,000 or $90,000.
So that's a flat tax plus the fact it has a ceiling on it, which means that it is not a flat tax. It really means that the more money you make, the smaller percentage of your income that you pay.
Right. So if we just did away with the cap on Social Security, that would solve Social Security's problem.
That would have sent, you know, people talk, our country has a lot of serious financial problems, no question about it. But in fact, the Social Security problem is not a terribly complicated one to solve. And as Tom just indicated, if we do away with the cap, which is now at around $90,000 a year, so that Bill Gates pays the same amount into Social Security as somebody making $90,000, you just do away with that. And in fact, you can play with the, but just doing away with that itself would solve the funding problem for Social Security into the indefinite future.
Yeah. Thomas in Tyler, Texas. You're live with Bernie Sanders. Thomas? No, Thomas. Okay. Andy in Erie. I'm sorry, Thomas. Not fast enough. Andy in Erie, Pennsylvania. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, guys. How you doing today?
Good.
I got a question for you, Bernie. First of all, I think that where I live is pretty much a crossroads of this country. I'm in southwestern New York. We got Pennsylvania, Ohio. I work for a distributor, and I deal with all three people in all three states every day. And I can tell you right now that people in Ohio are losing their jobs. Manufacturing is disappearing. People in New York are overtaxed, and people in Pennsylvania, they seem like they're losing their benefits. I mean, people that are trying to send their kids to college, they're just getting killed. Their federal grants are going down.
That's right.
They can't get a student loan. But I guess my question to you is this. We recently went independent, where our company was bought out by an international company, and now we're working for ourselves. And we have no benefits. We have no vacation. You know, I'm working 75 hours a week when I was working 45 to 50 before.
You're a trucker,
I have no life.
Trucker, Andy?
What's that?
Andy, you're a trucker?
I drive a truck. I don't want to get into specifics. I work in food service.
Yeah.
Okay? So we pay our checks. We had to buy our route to Bermuda.
Hey, Andy,
where the hell? So where's all this? But before, our company was located in the United States. They were paying taxes. We were paying taxes. We were giving to the government. The government's not our enemy. I mean, maybe it is inefficient to a certain extent, but you know, we have to maintain our government. How can they do this?
Andy, I mean, your story, what you've just said in 2 minutes, I mean, it encapsulates the stories of millions and millions of people. And I thank you for being as honest and straightforward as you are. In America, frankly, people should not have to work 70 or 75 hours to make a living. And in America, we should not be having to deal with companies who have moved offshore to Bermuda, in your case, with the specific and very predetermined goal of avoiding American taxes. A moment ago, we just talked about taxes. What kind of tax system do we want? Well, we sure as heck do not want a tax system in which large corporations can run to Bermuda so they can avoid paying their taxes, so the middle class has to pay more in taxes in order to make up for the loss of revenue. And that's clearly what we're seeing taking place. So I think, Andy, you have raised a whole lot of issues, the loss of manufacturing jobs in Ohio, which I know is devastating. In my small state of Vermont, in this small state, much smaller than Ohio, we have lost 20% of our manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years. What does that tell us? It tells us, among other things, that we need to change our trade policies. We need to demand a stop to outsourcing. We need to have corporate America start investing in America rather than in China. And this is something I hope will be at the very top of the agenda of the Democrats if, in fact, they are successful.
Jeff in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, Jeff.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering if either of you gentlemen have seen the article in today's New York Times entitled Congress Tells Auditor in Iraq to Close Office.
I have.
You've seen that, Tom?
Bernie, if you're not familiar with it, the Bush administration, there's an inspector of the Office of the Auditor General, which checks all of the expenditures
right.
in Iraq. And this guy is a Republican appointee, but he has sent several people to jail and has brought charges against Halliburton. And the Bush administration basically, in this last appropriations bill, had a little paragraph snuck in there that shuts down his office and fires him. And there's no longer going to be any more oversight of spending of money in Iraq.
And, well, the other thing, too, it was snuck in by Duncan Hunter's office.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is there anything illegal about that? Can they get away with that? Because apparently, according to the article, both Susan Collins and I believe another Republican in the Senate, and Susan Collins is a co-chair on that committee, they said this was not in the bill when we signed it, when we passed it on for reconciliation with the House.
Right.
And then Duncan Hunter put this in.
My guess is they probably did it legally. I recall a situation when Tom DeLay actually put in a provision for a company in Texas for himself after the conference committee did its work, and then it was then voted on by both bodies without knowing what was in it. But the issue here is not just how they did it, it's what they did. And the idea that in Iraq, where everybody knows there is huge amounts of corruption, there is huge amounts of waste, that the Bush administration will go out of its way to make sure that we don't learn about what's going on so that Halliburton and some of the other companies can rip us off even more is, again, beyond outrage. It is what these guys do every single day, and it's why this election on Tuesday is so important.
1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Robert in Miami, Florida. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hey, Robert.
Hi. I have a question for Tom.
Okay. Well, we're doing questions for Bernie
right
now. Yeah, go for it.
What?
Go for it.
Okay.
Turn your radio down and listen to the telephone and ask your question.
Okay. Basically, my question is this. I mean, I've heard at length, certainly not ad nauseum, all the problems that we can possibly expect during the voting. What I have not heard anybody mention is what is the government, especially the Democrats and independents, what are they doing? I know they're worried about it. Is there anything afoot to try to protect our election?
Yeah. Well, there are several things. I mean, there are things that are happening in Washington, the things that are happening at the statewide level. In Washington, some of us are on board legislation which would demand a paper trail, a backup for touchscreen voting machines. I think there is growing concern in Washington about the possibility that some of these machines could be hacked. And my view is that if there is any doubt about the reliability of these machines, if people doubt whether their votes are going to be counted accurately, then I would just as soon go back to paper ballots and until we can get a technology that we're 100% confident in. What you're also seeing, Robert, is at the statewide level, more and more attention is being paid to this issue. I think and not only among Democrats and progressives, some Republicans are also raising alerts about what's going on. There was a hearing a few months ago in Washington where some fellow was able to manipulate before the Congress and show how it is done to manipulate a voting machine. So we got problems, and obviously it's an issue that has to be focused on.
Yeah, there was a special on this on HBO last night. They're going to rerun it on Monday called Hacking Democracy.
That's the one that people was not happy about, right?
Yeah, it was mind-boggling. I watched it last night, and it's just incredible. Anyhow, and we had a guy from Canada call in last week. He said they use paper. It works just fine. 45 minutes past the hour.
In 1961, when Ike went out, the people in the South began to shout. In the last 8 years, everybody starved to death. The people up in Lucknow ain't even got breath. Please, Mr. Kennedy, won't you help us out? We ain't had a square meal in a long, long time. The farmers in Missouri, they ain't made a dime.
And welcome back. Virginia, campaign songs of days past? I'm not sure. 9.5 minutes before the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program where reason is our lifestyle choice. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie, John in Santa Monica is on the phone with us. Hey, John.
Good morning, Tom, and good afternoon, Bernie.
Good morning, John.
I have a question, sort of a hypothetical for you, Bernie. If you assume that everything is the same as it is today, November 3rd, but you're Bernie Sanders, private citizen, not public servant, given the history of the last several years and the poll data today, if you woke up November 8th and all the poll data was wrong and Republicans held the House and the Senate, what would you do?
Well, I'm not going to speculate. I don't think that, in fact, is going to happen. And, John, what I'll tell you I will do is in the next 4 days, I am going to be working my tail off, gone all over my state, and I think people all over America are going to be doing the same thing, making sure that as many people come out to vote as possible. We're going to have people at the polls to make sure that the votes are accurately counted. I think that getting a little bit paranoid doesn't help us. What we have got to do now is drive the vote. Let's worry about what happens the day after. But I am confident. I am confident not just on polls, but what I am seeing with my own eyes in terms of the excitement of people that on November 7th we're going to have a very good day.
Okay. Thomas in Tyler, Texas. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes. I have a question for Bernie. On Social Security and the stock market, you have Republicans running around excited about, well, giving the fear tactics that Social Security is going to collapse. And my observation is that if the old geezers like myself that are getting ready to retire, if we're going to be taken out of Social Security, is it also true we're going to be taking that same amount of money out of the stock market and not putting anything back into it? And why aren't they concerned that the stock market might collapse
right,
as well as Social Security?
Well, Thomas, Thomas, let me just say a couple of points. When President Bush goes around the country telling people that the Social Security is going bankrupt, he's just not telling the truth. Depending on the study that you look at, Social Security will be able to pay out all of the benefits owed to all of the American people who are eligible for Social Security from between 35 to 45 years. And then, at the end of that period, Social Security will be able to pay out about 75 or 80% of the benefits with modest changes. And Tom and I were just talking a moment ago that if you did nothing else but lift the ceiling so that wealthier people would be able to contribute more into the fund, you don't have a Social Security problem. And Social Security will be there for you, your kids, and your grandchildren. The idea of moving toward a private system where people are dependent for their retirement benefits on the ups and downs of the stock market is, to me, not a good idea. Social Security is not an investment system. It is an insurance system. And for over 70 years, Social Security has paid out every nickel owed to every eligible American, whether the stock market was up or whether the stock market was down. Now, just think what would happen if, God forbid, the stock market ever really crashed and people's retirement benefits were in that market. What happens then? What do we do? So I think if people want to invest in the stock market, go for it. It's doing well now. Sometimes it doesn't do well. That's your choice. But what Social Security is about is a social insurance program that has done a very, very good job in lifting not only millions of elderly people out of poverty, but in protecting the disabled, protecting widows and orphans who have lost the breadwinner in the family.
Kathleen in Seattle, Washington, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Gentlemen, good morning. I'm calling to ask Bernie, seriously, if there was a groundswell, would he run for president? No, we just need honest, independent voices. We have none.
Kathleen, thank you very much. As I think many listeners know, I'm running for the United States Senate right now, and I would be extremely pleased to hold that position, and that's what my immediate plans are. Thank you very much, though, Kathleen.
Jay in Atlanta, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, I had assumed when I called about the voting irregularities, I'm concerned about that both of you would stipulate that, yeah, there's no reason to have confidence in these machines. Bernie seems to think otherwise, despite RFK Jr.'s article about it and what Greg Palast and Mark Chris Miller have said about it. I don't understand how I can personally go up to a machine and after having read your book what would Jefferson do? I think if he was in there with me, he'd be saying, you're actually going to...
Jay, rather than a speech here, we're done.
Here's my suggestion. We're going to all go in there with a pen and a piece of paper and write down what our choices are. And we're going to have two voting poll people there sign it and two witnesses sign it. And those will be our records.
It sounds like a great idea, Jay, but I'm sorry. We're just out of time, and for the election, we're out of time to do that. Bernie, final thoughts for the day?
Well, this is my final thought. This is the last program that I will be on before this election. I think this election is the most important non-presidential election in my lifetime. I hope people will work hard for the remaining few days, and I hope that next Friday we can celebrate a major victory.
Indeed. From your lips to God's ears. Bernie Sanders. And thanks so much for being with us, Congressman Byrne.
Thank you very much, Tom. Bye-bye.
It's 56 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Coming up next, Cliff May of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He's going to tell us what a disaster it'll be if the Democrats are elected on Tuesday of next week. That should be interesting. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. So what would happen if the Democrats take the House, and even more interesting, take the Senate as well on Tuesday? Clifford May, the president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, defenddemocracy.org, the website, and a conservative stalwart. May I call you that, Cliff?
Yeah, sure. That's fine.
Okay. You suggest that there are two possible outcomes. The optimistic one is the Democrats, having given power, assume responsibly, and the other one, pessimistically, you say cut and run. Question. If you're tied to a stake and savages are about to light logs under your feet, what do you do? You cut and run. Or evildoers have tied you to railroad tracks and the Tehran Express is bearing down on you. If you got any brains at all, what are you going to do? You get out of there, don't you?
I think there are responsible Democrats who understand that a precipitous U.S. exit from Iraq would have catastrophic consequences, not just for Iraq, not just for the region, but for the U.S. too. And there are such voices in the Democratic Party and in the more liberal, even liberal think tanks, who, as critical as they are of President Bush and this administration for getting us to this juncture, do not think that the solution to it is to pull out and say whatever happens, happens. I think there are those who really do understand better than that. Now, will they be the ones who dominate after the elections if the Democrats take one or both houses? That I'm not sure of, but I think there's at least a possibility of that with power will come a desire to take responsibility.
No, the Democratic Party did a reasonably good job of prosecuting World War I and World War II and putting together Europe after World War II. I think that they've demonstrated they have the competence to do that. The Republican Party has never successfully fought and won a war, to the best of my knowledge. The Spanish-American War that they started ran on for over 40 years in the Philippines.
I think you make a good point that the Democrats in the past, under FDR, under Truman, under Kennedy, were not seen by most people, and were not, in fact, a party that was incapable or feckless when it comes to national security, defense matters, that sort of thing. They were branded that way later on, and they do have that reputation. They'll have 2 years after they take power, it seems to me, to either rebrand themselves as they used to be known in the days of Truman and Roosevelt and Kennedy, or to reestablish the idea that they simply cannot handle these kinds of issues. Keep in mind that during most of the Cold War, you didn't have a Democrat in the White House because of this branding. From 1969, when Johnson went out of office, to 1992, after the Cold War, when Clinton came back into the Oval Office, there's only a four-year period, one term, when you had a Democrat in the White House. That was Jimmy Carter. And Carter
and Reagan sure took care of him by cutting that deal with the Iranians, didn't he? Hey, listen, here's the question. If we got out of Vietnam, and Vietnam, not only did all of Southeast Asia not, you know, and the rest of the world, I mean, the argument was that the communists would be in California within 6 months if we got out of Vietnam. In fact, Vietnam actually became a relatively good citizen in the area. They stopped a genocide going on in neighboring Cambodia, and they started fighting against the Chinese who were trying to come in and occupy their territories. They had a border war with the Chinese. I mean, and right now, you know, the Vietnamese are manufacturing the shirt that I'm wearing. So if we were to get out of Iraq, wouldn't it make sense that Jordan and Syria and Iran, the countries that, and Saudi Arabia, the countries that are contiguous with Iraq, would suddenly say, hey, we've got a stake in this thing, rather than just sitting around and watching Bush blow himself up, you know, making America look bad, making Bush look bad. We've got a stake in this thing. We don't want this to spread into our areas. We're going to get involved and we're going to help clean this up.
Yeah, I think there are two big problems with that argument. One is that Ho Chi Minh in his worst days never thought, I'm going to go to the U.S. and blow up American children. He thought if he did something like that...
Neither do the insurgents in Iraq, Cliff May. The insurgents in Iraq are saying, get the hell out of our country. They're saying the exact same thing that you and I think, can agree we would say if Mexico or Canada invaded the United States.
First of all, you do still have an al-Qaeda presence in Iraq, and it is a...
And al-Qaeda themselves, the memo that the CIA intercepted just a month ago inside al-Qaeda said that they want us to stay there because if we leave, the Iraqis will turn against them just the same way that they've turned against us.
If your theory is that if we just get out, this problem will solve itself, I think you're
wrong. It's not nowhere near that simplistic, obviously. I think Joe Biden has a really good solution. Let's go back to the borders of the, pre-World War One creation of Iraq.
You can look to what Joe Biden and some and other people are saying, and I think there are some interesting arguments.
Let's do what we did with Kosovo.
But here's something else I really do think you're missing. If the strategy to throw the U.S. out of Iraq succeeds, there is nothing to stop that same strategy, which is essentially to kill as many civilians as you can and a few Americans when you have...
No, you're making a fundamental error of fact here, Cliff May. It's not Al-Qaeda that we're fighting in Iraq. It's Iraqis that we're fighting in Iraq. There are some folks from Al-Qaeda who are in there exploiting the situation, but according to the Pentagon, they're less than 3%, between 3 and 6% of the fighters. According to the Pentagon.
Yeah, the Shia, Al-Qaeda is not a huge presence, but it is a very important presence. It has its presence and its activities have gotten the sectarian violence to the state it is. When they blew up the mosque in Samarra, what that meant was the Shiites said, we know who did this. Al-Qaeda did it. The Sunnis are protecting Al-Qaeda. We'll show the Sunnis that they can't do that.
I believe that you're absolutely right in that regard. And that's why if we get out of Iraq, then there's no longer the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Then it will be, okay, the Al-Qaeda is not us. It's not about Iraq. Al-Qaeda was not homegrown in Iraq. Al-Qaeda came out of our efforts to promote Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. And they're toast. I mean, this is what, here you've got Al-Maliki telling us this. You've got the Bechtel has just announced that they're pulling out of Iraq because it's too dangerous. I mean, you've got the Central Command military analyst saying that the situation is sliding toward chaos. It's not because of Al-Qaeda. It's because of our presence there.
If our presence is removed there and it becomes clear that the way you get American presence out is, again, by killing civilians as much as you can on either side, then there will be suicide bombings going off in Kabul until we are thrown out of Afghanistan as well, which we will be. Then the bombs will go off in Jordan, and Jordan will be taken over. And there's nothing, and it's already starting in places like Bangladesh.
See, this is exactly what people were saying about Vietnam, and it's wrong.
I understand people were saying it about Vietnam, and because
it's wrong. What happens
in Vietnam does not mean it's not true here. You are saying that this analogy is a perfect analogy because it didn't happen that way in Vietnam. It can't happen here. Vietnam was peripheral to the Cold War. Iraq is central to the Middle East. Our enemies believe
Iraq is not central to Al Qaeda. Our presence in Al Qaeda in Iran is helping Al Qaeda, not hurting Al Qaeda.
Our enemies, which include Al Qaeda and also include the militant jihadists of Iran, all believe that this is the main front in the war we are fighting against militant Islam.
No, they think it's the main front in their recruiting efforts against us.
They believe this is, look, tell me if you are okay about seeing the U.S. Embassy burn down on CNN while militant Islamists cheer outside. Tell me if you're okay seeing Saddam Hussein taken from his cell and put back in his palaces. Tell me if all that works.
Well, according to the UN right now, the situation is worse for the average Iraqi than it was when Saddam Hussein was running the country.
And
I mean, your solution, there were no chemical weapons. Our troops are not greeted with chocolate and flowers. They're not greeted as liberators. There were no, you know, Bush was telling us.
Anything I'm saying, and look, I don't, and by the way, I don't care.
That's because it's a setup question. It's a simplistic setup question. This is a complex situation. We need to bring all these other countries together into Iraq and do like we did in Yugoslavia and say, okay, we're gonna balkanize this country. We're gonna split up. We're gonna do it with the actors in the area. It's not gonna be us. It's gonna be a regional solution.
When you say we bring, look, I don't care. I'm happy to talk to anybody, but before you sit down with Iran or Syria, you better know what you're going to say. There's no talking cure. If what you're going to say to Iran and Syria is...
And Jordan and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, Jordan and Saudi Arabia, I obviously have no problem with. We talk to them all the time. Don't think we don't talk to
Jordan. But Al-Qaeda's coming out of Saudi Arabia. I mean, you know, the Wahhabists are coming out of Saudi Arabia. So
they are. They have since the beginning. Saudi Arabia has been part of this problem going back more than 30 years because they have been preaching in Saudi Arabia every Friday night the idea of a holy war against the infidels. And finally, somebody, Osama bin Laden, said, are we serious about this holy war or not? If the infidels are vermin, who's going to exterminate them? If the Saudi princes can't do it because they're too busy shopping at Harrods, I'll do it. That's how this all came about. But the Iranians have been done the same thing from a Shiite perspective, starting more than 25 years ago with a revolution that had death to America as its main
So, again, as long as a country that is on the other side of the planet is the primary and dominant military force in the region, it's not going to solve itself. We need to bring in the actors in that region and bring in the United Nations like we did in Yugoslavia. I mean, this isn't rocket science, is it, Cliff May?
Yeah, it sort of is rocket science. At least it's complex. I don't know what you think the UN can do, but I'm not against bringing the UN in. I'm not against talking to anybody. But don't think sitting down and talking to people cures your problems. And don't think this problem goes away if you simply ignore it or run away from it. I don't think that's true.
Clifford May, president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, defenddemocracy.org, the website. Good talking with you, sir.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Calling America. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio. Our program supported by you, our listeners, by supporting our sponsors and our stations. If you're listening and enjoying, let the radio station know. And if you're considering buying anything, let our sponsors know. In particular, pay attention to the local sponsors. The local stations need your help and appreciate it. And also our national sponsors, Sacred Grounds Coffee, for example, saving the planet one cup at a time. 1-800-425-2532, their telephone number, sacredgroundscoffee.com, their website. If you plug fall, F-A-L-L, the season, into the coupon code as you're checking out, you'll get a 15% discount. Also, Small Dog Electronics, hit the latest iPods now and all things Macintosh, 1-800, all things computer, for that matter, 1-800-511-MAX, M-A-C-S, or smalldog.com, their website. And the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, ecowine.com. Their website. Welcome back to our program. 22 minutes past the hour. There's been all this talk about the October surprise. In fact, we're running a contest for it over on our message board, tomhartman.org, or tomhartman.com. Click message boards, and it'll flip you over to tomhartman.org. But might it be that it's going to be a November surprise? Two memes that I want to set up here in the 5 or 6 minutes before we take the break at the bottom of the hour, and then we can talk about it on the phone after that if you'd like to, you know, if you have thoughts on this or pontifications, considerations, objections, concerns. Number one, the White House has pretty much come out and said that they're launching a campaign to politicize Saddam Hussein's trial, which is going to, by coincidence, resolve on Monday. Sure enough, on Monday. This is Tony Snow. It starts out, it's Kramer? Kudlow? whichever the guy is there on CNBC, starts out with him, and then Tony Snow says, yeah, yeah, we're going to politicize this thing. Here you go.
Is there a November surprise coming out of Iraq? Will the Iraqi court find a guilty verdict for Saddam Hussein and a possible death sentence? Rumors are flying that it's going to come down this Sunday, November 5th, which, of course, will dominate the political news cycle in the last 2 days in the midterms. Tony, what can you tell us about this?
Well, Larry, that's when the verdict is scheduled to come down. I'm not going to tell you what it's going to be because I don't know, but you're absolutely right. It'll be a factor. But you know what? It may fit into a larger narrative about an Iraqi government that's been doing what the president has said all along, which is developing the capacity to sustain itself.
Quiet. The bottom line here, Tony Snow saying, yeah, we're going to use this thing for politics. Sure. You know, I mean, if you go back and you look at when Bush got bumps, he got bumps when Saddam was caught. He got bumps when Saddam's sons were killed. He got some bumps when Zarqawi was killed. And there's a pretty good guess that if on Sunday the court in Iraq finds Saddam Hussein guilty of crimes against humanity, all day Monday, that's what everybody's going to be talking about. And any discussion of any of the real issues in this election are going to be gone. It's the November surprise. Forget October surprises. That's too subtle for the Republicans. They're going to do it the day before the election. All day on the 6th of November, on Monday, the news stories, the news coverage is going to be all Iraq all the time. And all good news from Iraq, Saddam Hussein has been convicted. Here's what that SOB did. Listen to this. Listen to these crimes that he was convicted of. He was convicted of, and then he murdered these people, and then he did those people. And isn't it marvelous that George W. Bush, that noble guy, has taken him out? Number one. Story number one. Story number two. Yesterday, Alberto Gonzalez announced that 11,000 fugitives were arrested in one week-long sweep. It was called Operation Falcon 3. 100 murder suspects, 1,000 sex offenders who were unregistered, blah, blah, blah. 11,000 people. Now, here's the question. I can think of only two reasons why the government would want to arrest 11,000 people on one day or over a period of just, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 days. One reason would be that you want to shut them all up, or you're concerned that they're engaged in a conspiracy, you don't want them to be able to talk to each other. That's not the case here. These were all unrelated criminals. So why did the government, why did Alberto Gonzalez have the government find these people over a period of many months and then put the public at risk, assuming that these were actually criminals who should have been arrested, put the public at risk by leaving them free for weeks or months so that they could be arrested all on one day? Was it a publicity stunt timed to the election to make it look like the Bush administration is getting tough on crime, even though they did away with the 100,000 extra cops that Clinton put on the streets? Or is it B, a practice run? This is the third time they've done this. This is called Operation Falcon 3. A practice run for the single-day national roundup of thousands of people. When a button gets pushed in Alberto Gonzalez's office and he says, okay, it looks like the people are rising up about, for example, stolen elections. We've identified the 5,000 or 10,000 potential leaders around the country, all the people who've been leading the peace protests and speaking out and been on talk radio and whatnot. Take them out. Take them out right now. Take them out fast. Could it be that that's really what it's all about? Could it be that it's practice? Hey, time now for our progressive pop quiz. Our question for the day, Saddam Hussein's trial is scheduled to end when? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466 gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed.
Did my ballot go? Lost my faith in the government when they changed the rules without my consent. Don't wanna be nobody's experiment. Just wanna know where my ballot went. They lost.
And welcome back, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut. also known as Portland, Oregon. Welcome back. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Our question was Saddam Hussein's trial is scheduled to end when? And congratulations to Eric Serber in Arcata, California. Hey, congratulations, Eric. He knew that the answer is Sunday, Monday, more or less. It's the official date is the 5th. It's going to play out, which is Sunday, but it's going to play out on Monday in American television. And, of course, that's the day before the election. Gee, what a surprise. Now, back to this question. And here we have, now, I'm not positioning myself as any sort of expert on law enforcement. I mean, I wrote four and a half novels about a private detective. And this was back 10, 15 years ago. And I was very curious, you know, you want to do the research, right? I was curious about that world, as it were, and I'd always enjoyed reading those kind of books, and so I thought, take a shot at writing something. So I wrote a series about this character who was a private detective, and I hooked up with a PI down in Atlanta, Georgia. We were living in Atlanta at the time, a guy by the name of DeWitt Wanamaker, who ran a private detective agency. And it was the year that Atlanta hosted the Olympics, and Atlanta didn't have enough police officers to offer security for the Olympics. And so for the first time in its 130-some-odd-year history, the Georgia Police Academy decided to open their doors to a training program for private detectives to give them, you know, basic Secret Service training on security so people could get, you know, licensed essentially to work at the, you know, for the Olympics, to do security for the Olympics. And so I went through that program. DeWitt called me up and he said, hey, you want to go through the Georgia Police Academy's program? It's a shortened version of, you know, what they offer to police departments on how to train a law enforcement officer. And I said, sure, it sounds like fun. And so we went down there for a couple of weeks and went through this program. And I'd say probably three quarters of the people in the program with me were police officers from small towns around Georgia who were looking to make some extra money during the Olympics. And I mean, everything from hand-to-hand combat to how to turn a car around without blowing tires out, you know, and hitting it was a hoot, and a lot of legal stuff, and so you know, I've had some small amount of insight into that world and into the really quite very real and significant subculture of law enforcement. But I don't pretend to be any kind of, and what came out of that was that I got licensed as a private detective in the state of Georgia and had a badge and a license and a license to carry a concealed weapon if I wanted. I never did for the better part of 4 years, well, the last couple of years that we lived in Georgia. But, you know, again, I'm not any kind of expert on law enforcement, but I do have some common sense. And I can only come up with, and if any of you in law enforcement, Bill, our retired police detective up in Chicago, if you're listening, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. You call into the program fairly regularly. Why would a federal agency, in this case, you know, the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, Alberto Gonzalez, why would they identify over 11,000 criminals, fugitives, over a period of months? Presumably this took, you know, 3, 6, 9 months. Why would they identify them and not sweep them? Why not? You know, you identify a guy who's got over 100 people who are suspects for murder, 100 people wanted for murder, and they didn't arrest them when they found them. They instead waited until yesterday. Why? If they were doing it as a publicity stunt to try to look strong for the elections. First of all, I think it probably fell flat on its face, but who knows? I mean, maybe it'll get some legs. It did make the news cycle last night. You know, it did make the evening news in most of the networks. But I think it subjects them to criticism. I mean, you found a murderer 4 months ago and you didn't arrest him? Or an alleged murderer? So they could be doing it as a publicity stunt, or is this a dry run? Am I being paranoid here? I'm looking at the fact that the Bush administration got written into the last defense appropriations bill a little codicil, a little clause that said, by the way, for all practical purposes, we're doing away with the Posse Comitatus Act. Now, Oddly enough, you know who's talking about this stuff? Right-wing, far right-wing talk radio. I'm talking about like the shortwave stations out of Denver, you know, that are listened to by the white supremacists and whatnot all across America. They're flipped out about this. The mainstream media not going near it. But frankly, those folks who think that they may be the victims of a government sweep, the ones who are saying, okay, they're keeping records on it. I mean, we now know, for example, that the Department of Homeland Security had infiltrated and was keeping records on a Quaker group, the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker group of pacifists who were holding nonviolent anti-Iraq war rallies and protests. We know that they're doing this all over the country. So is this practice for the day when Alberto Gonzalez says, okay, the people are rising up. Stop. Stop them now. And a button gets pushed or a phone call gets made, and all across the country, 5, 10, 15,000 people. I mean, this is 11,000 people last week got arrested all bang, just like that, over a period of just a couple of days. And all across the country, 11,000 people, 15,000 people, 20,000 people who just happen to be the leaders of protest movements on the right and the left just vanish. Just vanish. Yeah, you think that that's crazy. It is actually something that the mainstream right has actually made jokes about.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Thank you, Mr. O'Reilly, for making my point. So, you know, unless I'm missing something here, I can come up with nothing more than two reasons why they would do this. But they've done it three times now. You could argue this third one was a stunt, a publicity stunt, but what about the other two? What's the deal? Why is the federal government practicing mass nationwide sweeps, preempting local law enforcement or co-opting local law enforcement? Massive nationwide sweeps. Why? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jude in Seattle. Hey, Jude, your thoughts?
Well, Tom, I don't think you're paranoid, because when I heard the information last night, I immediately stopped in my steps. And the article that we received said that between April and the Seattle Times, between April 2005 and April 2006, that there were over 20,000. So the figure is around 37,700.
This is in all three Operation Falcons.
Correct.
Where they've been practicing how to do a nationwide roundup of people at the drop of a dime.
Exactly. And how does one find out information about these individuals that have been picked up? That's a horrendous amount. And then, Tom, I have to take you back to that lady that called from Medina yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
That was the most stilling piece of interchange that I've heard. And my mind is always blown away now with what's going on. Mm-hmm. But to think that she can stand in that secure area of Medina where Gates lives, on her corner in a running outfit, and maybe, you know, one shouldn't flip someone off, but we still have the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. And for someone, I'm a retired hospice nurse, I would never think of doing anything derogatory, but I have moments that I'm so outraged by what's going on, and I fight for my grandkids, that I don't know if maybe that might happen. But to have them roll a window down and point assault rifles at her?
Right. Yeah.
If I did that, pulled an assault rifle, I'd be picked up in a second.
Yes, it's a crime
to
point a loaded weapon at people in the United States, unless apparently you're the security detail for George W. Bush.
So you're not paranoid, and thank you very much, Tom, for making me feel like I'm not some kind of nut out there. I truly believe something's going on. People really need to pay attention. So bless your heart. Thanks for everything, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you, Jude. Cindy in Pittsburgh. Hey, Cindy, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm in the bread store, but I had to call you real quick when I heard this. Rex 84, remember Oliver North hatched this plan to suspend the Constitution and to round people up?
That's right. That was during the Iran-Contra thing.
That's right. So people need to look into that. And I'm going to hurry and get back in the car so I can finish listening to the show.
Okay. Thanks, Cindy. Good to hear from you. Rex 84. David, Google that thing so we can talk about it after the break. We're tracking that thing down. I remember that vaguely, but I'm not quite the Ollie North expert that, for example, Randy Rhodes is. So, Lana in Index, Washington. Hey, Lana, we just have a few seconds before I have to take a break. Is it a quickie?
It is. You know, I just want to thank you for bringing this up because I have been thinking the same thing, that this is so weird. What are they doing?
So I'm not crazy.
You know, if they knew they were there, why didn't they get them sooner?
Yeah, well, it's either a publicity stunt or it's practice for something. And if it's a practice for something, I can't think of what it would be other than what I put out. And you know, I hope I'm wrong. I really hope I'm wrong, because that's a scenario that I don't think any of us want to contemplate. Lana, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Great to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour is the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. Are we sliding toward fascism, or are we simply getting a little too Reich? We'll be... It's a beautiful day. Skyfall, you feel like it's a beautiful day. So let it get away. On the road. And welcome to the place where being progressive never felt so good. 9.5 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program from Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia. Rex 84, short for Readiness Exercise, 1984. Was a plan by the United States federal government to test their ability to detain large numbers of American civilians, or citizens rather, in case of massive civil unrest. Exercises similar to Rex 84 happened periodically. From 1967 to 1971, the FBI kept a list of persons to be rounded up as subversive, dubbed the ADEX, A-D-E-X list. That's from Wikipedia. From October Surprise, Barbara Honegger's book. This is the epilogue. Barbara Honegger, her picture on the back of the book with Ronald Reagan shaking one of her hands and George Herbert Walker Bush shaking the other. She worked in the Reagan White House, part of the transition team, left the White House to blow the whistle on Reagan and Bush cutting a deal with the whole October surprise thing, cutting a deal to hold the hostages. Her epilogue opens. President Reagan signed intelligence authorizations in 1984 and 1985, which were considered licenses to kill, according to top government officials. As we have seen, Oliver North and Amiram Nir's U.S.-Israeli covert operations were authorized by a still-secret accord never revealed to congressional intelligence committees as required by law, which may have also authorized political assassinations in the name of counterterrorism. Author Seymour Hersh has charged Oliver North with being President Reagan's assassination planner. We have reviewed reports in this book that North boasted that anyone who leaked or threatened to reveal the administration's secret Iran initiative would be killed, and that some of the North Secord Hakim team were reportedly involved in political assassinations under the umbrella of counterterrorism. She says, given this context, it's instructive to note what happened to many of the individuals who were reportedly involved in or knew about secret negotiations between Iran and the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign and or other secret U.S. arms deliveries to the Khomeini regime in the early 1980s. And then she goes through a list of all the people, you know, dead, William Casey, dead, Amiram Nir, dead, Cyrus Hashemi, dead, the Ayatollah Beheshti, dead, Sagbeg Gotsbedeh, dead, William Buckley, dead, Arnold Raffi, and gives the circumstances of the death of each one of them. It just goes on for page after page after page. Bill, our friend in Chicago, the retired police detective. Hey, Bill, you know a whole lot more about policing than I do. Am I off base on this thing?
Well, first of all, let me say I missed the news cycle yesterday, so I'm not really up on the specifics of this.
Well, here, I'll just read you the first paragraph. Nearly 11,000 fugitives, including 1,659 sex offenders and over 100 murder suspects, were swept up in what Attorney General Gonzalez described Thursday as a record-breaking law enforcement operation targeting some of the nation's, quote, worst felons, end quote. Focused in 24 states east of the Mississippi, the week-long Operation Falcon 3 roundup, and then they go, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I was on the Chicago Police Department, and Chicago is a very political city, so we tend to be familiar with the politics of it. And I would say, generally speaking, this is probably the tough on law enforcement, we can get the immigrants, everything, you know, that type
this
of
is a,
thing.
You think it's a PR stunt?
Right, they're trying to put out. The thing here is, I'd say that you'd really have to look at those statistics. First of all, You know, there are the vast majority of murderers are arrested by state and local police.
Right.
So I don't know why the federal government is picking up murderers. I mean, there are some murder federal crimes, obviously, on a federal reservation and stuff like that.
Well, apparently this is some sort of federal, state, local cooperation.
Right, yeah. You know what I'd say? I'd say you'd probably really have to look at those statistics, and I'm guessing what they've done is they've taken the regular activities of thousands of local, county, and state police, plus the federal government, across a period of time, and lumped them together into a nice little news item to put out.
Yeah.
You know,
except
I mean, I'm not saying that they couldn't. And my what frightens me generally about this administration is the two safeguards to Americans from their own government has always been, obviously, judicial review.
Right,
you know,
the Fourth Amendment.
The judiciary having to review the actions of the police or the executive branch. And the other thing is the general bumbling and incompetence of the government and their agencies.
Right. Also there's posse comitatus, too, as well.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And all three of those, you know, the bumbling and incompetence, you know, I don't know about that, but the Fourth Amendment has been eviscerated.
Oh,
and
right.
Posse comitatus just got knocked
right.
down. These are the things that protect us.
Right. That's what scares me, because without that judicial review, without that ability for somebody to come in and take a look at what they're doing, and you publicly to demand, you know, an address of a grievance like that, That's what frightens me. And, of course, we have to realize in the past, we had the Palmer raids during the 1920s or whatever like that to get all the Reds and all
right.
this stuff. So
yeah, Woodrow Wilson actually, you know, was
right.
behind the Democratic president was
right.
was encouraging his Justice Department to do that. You're right. And
yeah.
and people were arrested for simply what they said.
Yeah, and again, those people were denied, an awful lot of them were denied any kind of judicial review. They were stuck on boats and shipped out of the country, you know, without
yeah.
a chance to go in front of a court and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's what really scares me. But I'll bet you if you took a look at that statistic from from their news release, I'll bet you a lot of that is just the normal activity. The federal government is great at that. They they take bank robberies and take credit for them when, you know, the local police or some citizens stop the bank.
Oh, yeah. J. Edgar Hoover turned that into an art form with car thefts. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Bill, thanks a lot for the call and
sure.
for the heads up. I appreciate it.
I always enjoy listening, Tom.
Well, thank you. Thanks for calling in.
Okay.
56 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll continue with this topic and more. There's a lot of other stuff in the news as well with your calls right after the news at the top of the hour. 866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, just go to TomHartman.com and click on over there. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
So let me just tell you two quick stories from long ago and far away that highlight all of this for me and that will perhaps give you an understanding of where I'm coming from in this, to the extent that I may sound like I'm being paranoid or whatever. By the way, welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. In the late 1960s, I was living out in East Lansing, Michigan, and going to college, and was part of, shall we say, loosely affiliated with. There was, to the best of my knowledge, not an official membership roster. But Students for Democratic Society, SDS. And at the meetings that we would have, sometimes public and sometimes private. And I wasn't, you know, I'm not putting myself out as some kind of big shot or even a major participant, frankly, with SDS at that time in East Lansing. But I was there. And at the meetings, there was this guy who was he was kind of an odd duck because most of us had, you know, most of us had long hair and looked rather scruffy. And this guy was kind of clean cut. But he knew the right rhetoric, and he sure, you know, he knew all the details of all the crimes that LBJ had committed in Vietnam and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But he was the one who was always saying, you know, we got to bust a few windows when we do this march. Or, you know, if we're going to do, you know, I mean, this kind of stuff. I mean, he was the guy who was always trying to push us or to push the people around him to violence. And years later, I mean, this is there's an old friend of mine in East Lansing who every year has a party at his house, and a lot of us show up. And if last couple of years, I've seen my old friend Mike Price. Mike was way up at SDS, and you know, a major leader of SDS at Michigan State University. He's now actually speaking before campus groups in East Lansing about what SDS was like in the 60s and the early 70s. And so anyhow, 10 years ago or so. So we're now like, you know, it's 20 years later. Some of the folks who were involved in this decided to sue. Well, actually, it was longer ago than that. It must have been about 20 years ago. Decided to sue the Michigan State Police and sue the FBI and do FOIA, you know, requests and all that kind of stuff. Get their files. And the guy in the back of the room who was always yelling for violence, turns out he was I don't remember if he was with the state police or with the FBI. He was basically on the other side. He was trying to incite violence. Now this is no surprise to anybody. This happened all across the United States. And there's hundreds of cases of it. But I was there. A decade later, in the 1970s, this was probably around 1975. My partner of mine and I had a business in Michigan, an ad agency, and in the mornings I was doing news at a radio station in Lansing, the WITL, country western station, and you know, I'd go in at 5 a.m., 6 a.m., I'd do the police rounds and go into the radio station, you know, with the audio for the day and slice it up, and then, you know, I was the news anchor during morning drive and, you know, get everything together for the afternoon crew. And then I'd be out of there by 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning and, you know, go run my business. And one morning I was there, and there were a couple of us there who worked in the newsroom and, a couple other local, the DJ and, you know, there's half a dozen people around. And these two guys show up with the skinny black ties and the highly polished black shoes, and flash their ID at us. And one of them, as I recall, one of them was from the IRS and the other was from the FBI. And then there was a county sheriff or a state cop, I forget what, local law enforcement with them. And they said, you know, we'd like to talk to you. And, you know, they kind of got us all together in the newsroom. I could see this as if it happened yesterday. This is one of those, you know, shocking moments, startling moments. So we'd like to talk to you guys. And one of these guys was like Mr. Big Shot, and the other guy was Mr. Friendly. And Mr. Big Shot says, I want to see everybody's driver's license before we go any farther. I got to know who I'm talking to. So we're all pulling out our driver's licenses, and he takes them, and he's writing down our driver's license numbers, and then he hands them back to us. And then the other guy, Mr. Friendly, says, just wanted you to know that later this afternoon we're going to be doing a raid on some tax protesters here in Central Michigan. Now, there's a lot of tax protesters in Central Michigan. Central Michigan's kind of a hotbed of John Birch Society kind of stuff, you know, out in the rural areas. And he says, you know, we're going to be doing a raid. We're going to be arresting a couple of dozen people who are refusing to pay their federal taxes. And we would appreciate it if you did not publicize it, if you did not report on it. And Mr. Tough Guy is standing there with his piece of paper with our driver's license numbers on it, looking at us like, this is more than we would appreciate. These guys leave. It's been made very clear to us, although it was never said overtly. Consider yourself threatened. And I remember we had a big discussion about it, in the two or three of us, four of us, I forget how many, who were directly involved with the news. I think there was only three of us in the newsroom involved with the news at that time. Then there was the DJ and the program director. Should we report the story? And it was sort of, do you want to take on the feds? No, I don't think so. Do you want to take on the feds? But it's news. But is it really all that important? You know, and it was like, but the bottom line is, frankly, I mean, you know, here I am. I was, in 74, I would have been 23 years old. We were, you know, and all of us, I mean, and the news director was probably only 5 years older than I was. And it's, I'll tell you the truth, it scared the hell out of all of us. And we did not report the story. So, I've seen this. And it concerns me. And then I read this story about there's been these three now, Operation Falcon 1, Operation Falcon 2, and Operation Falcon 3. Here's the Vermont version. This is in the Rutland Herald. A week-long fugitive sweep into the eastern and central United States has led to almost 11,000 wanted criminals taken into custody, including 83 from Vermont. Now, Vermont is a little state. I mean, there's fewer people in the state of Vermont than there are in the city of Portland, Oregon, where I live now. Including 83 from Vermont and 8 from Rutland County. This is from the Rutland Herald, the Rutland County, Vermont. In Vermont, the roundup was led by the U.S. Marshals Service and included several local and law enforcement agencies around the state. The sting was codenamed Operation Falcon 3. National figures on fugitives captured were released Thursday in Washington, D.C., while the figures from the Vermont operation were announced at a press conference in Burlington attended by federal, state, and local law enforcement officials. Vermont U.S. Marshal John Edwards said in a written statement released Thursday, when we share information and pool our resources toward a common goal, the results are safer communities for our children and a more secure homeland. Now, first of all, whenever I hear people talking about homeland, it gives me the creeps. It reminds me of when Rudolf Hess in 1934 stood up and for the first time used the word Heimat. Heimat, to say in Heimat, the German word for homeland.
Dank Ihrer Führung.
Thanks to your leadership.
Wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen.
And Germany is
Heimat zu sein.
Germany is now the homeland. The homeland for all
Heimat
the Germans.
Zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt.
In the world. That was 1934, November 1934, when the word homeland was introduced into the German lexicon. Vermont U.S. Marshal John Edwards said in a written statement, when we share information and pool our resources toward a common goal, the results are safer communities for our children and a more secure homeland. In total, the operation in Vermont led to the capture of 83 people and cleared 110 arrest warrants for various offenses, ranging from failure to register as a sex offender to drug offenses, Bill Gerke of the U.S. Marshal Service in Vermont said after the press conference. Well, I hope that this is a good thing. You know, I want law enforcement to do their job. We pay our taxes. We want our police to protect us, right? I'll take your calls after this. 16 minutes past the hour.
Was in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, when the road was full of mud. I come in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. If I pass this way again, you can rest assured I'll always do my best for her, on that I give my word. In a world of steel-eyed death and men who have fightings to be warm,
come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the sun.
And welcome to the reality-based world. Fair and slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. This from Consortium News, printed over at alternet.org, one of those notorious left-wing websites, by Nat Perry. Posted on February 23rd, 2006. Not that George W. Bush needs much encouragement, but Senator Lindsey Graham suggested to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez a new target for the administration's domestic operations. Fifth columnists, supposedly disloyal Americans, who sympathize and collaborate with the enemy. Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, told Gonzalez during Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on February 6th, quote, the administration has not only the right but the duty, in my opinion, to pursue fifth column movements. I stand by this president's ability, inherent to being commander-in-chief, to find out about fifth column movements, and I don't think you need a warrant to do that. Graham added, volunteering to work with the administration to draft guidelines for how best to neutralize this alleged threat.
Senator, a smiling Gonzalez responded, the president already said we'd be happy to listen to your ideas.
In less paranoid times, Graham's comments might be viewed by many Americans as a Republican trying to have it both ways, ingratiating himself to an administration of his own party while seeking some credit from Washington centrists for suggesting Congress should have at least a tiny say in how Bush runs the war on terror. But recent developments suggest that the Bush administration may already be contemplating to do with Americans who are deemed insufficiently loyal or who disseminate information that may be considered helpful to the enemy. Top U.S. officials have cited the need to challenge news that undercuts Bush's actions as a key front in defeating the terrorists, who are aided by, quote, news informers, end quote, using the words of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Plus, there was that curious development in January when the Army Corps of Engineers awarded Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root a $385 million contract to construct detention centers somewhere in the United States to deal with, quote, and this is from a Kellogg Brown and Root press release, an emergency influx of immigrants into the United States or to support the rapid deployment of new programs, end quote. Later, the New York Times reported, quote, KBR will build the Centers for the Homeland Security Department for an unexpected influx of immigrants to house people in the event of a natural disaster or for new programs that require additional detention space. New programs? When asked about it, Jamie Zweibach, a spokeswoman for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service, declined to elaborate on what these, quote, new programs might be. Peter Dale Scott speculated that, quote, the detention centers could be used to detain American citizens if the Bush administration were to declare martial law, end quote. He recalled that during the Reagan administration, National Security Council aide Oliver North organized Rex 84, a readiness exercise which contemplated the Federal Emergency Management Agency rounding up and detaining 400,000, quote, refugees, end quote, in the event of, quote, uncontrolled population movements, end quote, over the Mexican border into the United States. Daniel Ellsberg said almost certainly this is preparation for a roundup after the next 9/11. For Mideasterners, for Muslims, and possibly dissenters. They've already done this on a smaller scale. You'll remember, you know, right after 9/11, the Bush administration rounded up over 1,000 people inside the United States. Many of them disappeared. We still have no idea where they are. By the way, one of our regular informants, as it were, just let us know that Ellen Simon, who is running for the House of Representatives in the 1st District in Arizona, a progressive who is so progressive, like Nancy Skinner, who we talked with yesterday, that the DCCC isn't throwing a lot of money her way. She's now within the margin of error to win that race in the Arizona 1st District. This is incredible. It's ellensimonforcongress.com, I think. It might be .org, is her website. I'm pretty sure, though, it's Ellen Simon
skinnerforcongress.com. And of course, Nancy Skinner's site is skinnerforcongress.com if you're looking for an opportunity to help out some progressive candidates here at the last minute. Let me strongly encourage you to check out EllenSimonForCongress.com and SkinnerForCongress.com. A couple of good people there. So anyhow, what's up with this? Here, this, a school safety drill that included police, this is from the Associated Press, that included police officers in riot gear with weapons has caused concern among some parents in that it was too realistic and frightened some students. This was in the Grand Rapids, Michigan area. Some of these kids were so scared they just wet their pants, said Marge Bradshaw, a parent with four children in the school. I think it's pure wrong that the students and parents were not informed of this. Officers wore protective gear, including vests and helmets, and carried rifles. Whoa. 27 minutes past the hour. I'll take your calls right after this. Tom Harbin radio program. We're tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Hey, we never did figure out who Jeff Gannon was visiting all those times, did we?
Interesting.
Yes, Ensville in the chat room says, Tom, they're also prepping kids to comply with SWAT raids. Here's a link, and that's to an Arizona, Phoenix, ArizonaCentral.com, the Phoenix newspaper article about a similar story to the one that I was just reading about Grand Rapids. SWAT attacks in public schools. On this day in history, by the way, tip of the hat to the folks in the chat room. In 1794, Thomas Paine was released from a French jail after the intervention of the new American minister, James Monroe, who would later be president of the United States. And a fine thing it was. Jerry in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, you're not paranoid. I just wanted to be another one to call in and say that.
Either that or we're all paranoid.
Well, if we're all paranoid, it's normal. in today's world, maybe that's the answer.
Yeah.
The two suggestions that you made, I don't think, you know, they have to make a choice. I think it's a twofer for them. They get the public... publicity stunt benefit, as well as being able to pursue a live fire exercise under real conditions that they can't be criticized for because it's aimed at a group of criminals who doesn't.
Yes, law enforcement. In fact, there was one guy down in Georgia that they actually had a shootout with and killed.
Yeah.
In the course of this thing.
But this guy's a criminal, so that's okay.
Yeah.
And I just see it as a continuum. I think that, you know, these attitudes of, you know, wanting to rule somebody, just keep on.
Yeah.
You take it back.
So you see here the parallels to the Nixon era.
Yeah. I see much parallel to the Nixon era. You know, J. Edgar Hoover compiled millions of pages of dossiers on everybody from, you know, the Pope to the local butcher.
Oh, I know. I was in his files.
Yeah.
Probably still am.
and, you know, when they grabbed up the Black Panthers and a lot of the anti-war activists at that time, they weren't as organized and good at it. But this thread of desire, you know, to control the population by, people that are at peace with the aristocratic view, they look for a home, and it seems like they've been congregating in the Republican Party for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is. There is, you know, this basic human desire to simply have safety and security. I mean, those are the bottom two on Maslow's hierarchy of human needs.
Mm-hmm.
And a state that says, well, you can have safety and security. Freedom is a higher need. It's actually, you know, it's an intellectual construct. And so, if Maslow was right Abraham Maslow, the psychologist who came up with this hierarchy of human needs, number one, safety, people, actually the first needs are the homeostatic needs, the need to eat, to breathe, to drink, to use the bathroom, and to regulate body temperature. Once those needs are met, then people look to make sure that they're safe. And, you know, in other words, are people shooting at me? Is a piano about to fall on my head? Once people feel that they're safe, then they want to make sure that they're secure, that there's some, you know, in other words, safety in the context of time. Am I going to continue to be safe? And then once those basic needs are met, which are outside the realm of rationality, these are needs that every animal, I mean, insects will try to secure for themselves.
Right.
Once those needs are met, then people start climbing the ladder of the hierarchy of human needs into the emotional needs of community and the intellectual needs of understanding and intellect and the spiritual needs of enlightenment and you know, whatever. And so if you continually deal with, you know, I wrote an op-ed piece a couple of years ago about Dick Cheney activates the lizard brain.
Yep.
And, you know, weirdly enough, about 3 months later, Arianna Huffington came up with a very similar one and is continuing to use the meme. So good on her for doing that. But it's one that's been around for a long time in any case of, you know, talking to the brainstem, you know, talking to the security, that bottom of Maslow's pyramid part. It's very politically effective.
Yeah. And my question is I've never understood the folks that, are the lizard, you know, they're doing the talking.
Oh, well, you mean like the Bush and the Cheneys? Well, they're doing it out of a fundamental insecurity. They have at some deep level a profound insecurity that can only be satisfied. They can only cause themselves to feel secure if they feel like they have their hand around somebody else's throat, if they feel like they have absolute power. That's one of the reasons people seek power, is because they feel powerless.
Well, and, I wasn't going to say that, but that's what I believe too.
No, I mean, this is Psych 101. I mean, this is and not psychobabble 101. I mean, this is just, you know, this is there's no disputing this. It's so anyway, I got to move along. Thanks a lot, Jerry, for the call. John in Logansport, Indiana. Hey, John.
How's it going, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. I hope.
Hey, I knew you were going to say that.
So what's up?
Speaking of Innsville, that's me. So it's cool that you got that. But what I wanted to call in for was we already covered it, the SWAT team going into the middle school.
Yeah.
And, well, it seems to me that this is kind of their way around posse comitatus, is what you're seeing is more integration of military tactics into the police force.
Yeah.
And it seems like a loophole for them.
So, in other words, you don't have to bring the military in to pacify a community. You simply militarize the police. But as long as the police have their roots in the community, there's always going to be a natural human resistance to shoot at their neighbors.
Right, we can hope so. But it seems, even now, you see sort of the police force, they seem other. I mean, they refer to us as civilians, you know, and it's sort of a gradual integration like that, I think.
But police have always referred to civilians as civilians. I mean, police departments have always been basically military in their culture. At least throughout my lifetime, and you read the old police, you read the old Dashiell Hammett novels from the 30s, you know, about what it was like in Los Angeles, and you get it that, you know, I mean, that's just the nature of police work, I think. But, you know, anyhow, well, who knows? I mean, who knows? Ken in Sacramento, thanks for the call. Ken in Sacramento. Hey, Ken.
Hey, how's it going? I have a comment and a question for you, and I'll make it real quick. Okay, so you're looking at a system in which we're having all of our phone calls monitored, emails monitored, all computer actions monitored.
And they're bragging about it.
What's that?
And they're bragging about it.
Well, of course they've got a political enemies list here, but they talk about these KBR detention facilities being done. Posse comitatus is gone. Habeas corpus is gone. They're doing dry runs on picking up 11,000 people. I mean, connect the dots, people. This is not rocket science. I mean, you can see what's happening. My question is, if this really starts going down, what will the international reaction be to this against us?
Well, I think the international reaction will be, hey, it's not our problem.
Really? Because I have to look at how the United States looked at maybe Germany during World War II and say, well, no, you can't do this.
No. We, you know, Hitler was exterminating people in Germany, and we were saying, hey, it's not our problem. I mean, we didn't enter World War II until we got attacked by the Japanese, and that was very late in the game.
What would it take for our international allies to look at what's going on here in the United States and finally start bringing up and saying, hey, you guys are going down a path that we can't continue on? And
they're already saying that.
I mean, you have politicians in Europe speaking out. I mean, in the German parliament 2 years ago, in the British parliament right now, we had George Galloway on this program speaking. You know, you've got politicians around the world saying the United States is going down a road that it has never gone down before, and we fear for your future. But we're not going to invade your country and help you out. Sorry.
Well, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about what happens if there's enough American citizens that say, oh, my God, look what's happening here. We need help. I mean, are we going to be eventually looking at amnesty from other countries to allow us in? Because I'm really beginning to get scared, Tom. I mean, yeah. I've got a degree in sociology, and I see what's happening, and it scares the hell out of me.
Yeah, well, number one, don't be afraid. That's, you know, I mean, when Roosevelt said the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, there was never a more true word spoken.
Right.
You cannot confront this kind of behavior, this kind of seizing of power by government with
wrong fear. Here. How about intrepidation?
Yeah. I think, you know, an intellectual-based, an intellect-based concern is, or trepidation, whatever you want to call it, is a healthy thing. Fear is not healthy. Fear paralyzes people.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in fact, just for all of our collective edification, let's just hear it one more time.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
And so that's why it's so important that we be politically active in these days leading up to the election. It's why it's so important. Yeah, that we contact candidates that we can support and toss 25, 50 bucks, whatever you can afford their way. You know, why we show up at the protests and the rallies and you know, it's just.
Oh, let me tell you, I'm poll watching on Tuesday for 15 hours straight, so my buck is in that bank.
Good on you, Ken. I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to
got
hear
it.
From you. Barry, also in Sacramento, listening on KSAC. Hey, Barry.
Yeah, how's it going?
It's good. Hey, Barry, I've got to take a break here in 10 seconds. Let me just put you on hold, okay? And we'll pick you up on the other side because, you know, I want to give you a minute or two to talk or whatever is appropriate. I know that 10 seconds is just not going to do it. So anyhow, this topic, is this just a PR stunt, Operation Falcon 3? Is it just the Bush administration, Gonzalez, trying to, you know, get a little mojo before the election? Or is this a dry run for something more insidious? And if so, what is that? And if so, what can we do about it? 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. 866-440-8466, our number. We'll be right back.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, special thanks to my producer, we'll make sure that all you guys get on the FBI list here, to my producer David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark, Clay Kaplis, Andrew Dunn, Lauren Kirchner, Julian Suckman. All the folks at Air America who help produce this program, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt, who runs our chat room and our message boards, and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thank you so much. Welcome back 9 minutes before the hour to Barry in Sacramento. Hey, Barry.
Hey, I think all this stuff that you're talking about is they're both designed as PR stunts and for something more insidious. They're designed to condition the public into accepting that Department of Homeland Security is here to keep us safe from terrorists and criminals, and that these Halliburton detention camps are for our safety, and we might as well just take biometric RFID chips while we're at it.
Well, they're going to be in our driver's license and our passports within the next couple of years. I mean, that's already law now.
Well, exactly. It's all happening. And the larger point that I want to make is that if there's a large-scale terror attack on American soil, nuclear, biological, do not think that it is Al-Qaeda. It is Cheney and his backers. It's the Kissingers and it's the Rockefellers of the world who stage, manage, and provocateur most of the terror that we see, because the war on terror is not fundamentally a war against Islamic radicals, but it is against the American people and free societies.
Yeah.
And if we don't wake up to the fact that 9/11 was an inside job, a product of the military-industrial complex, we might as well just kiss America goodbye and welcome our new dictator, George W. Bush, And that's my comment.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You know, Barry, what's scariest about your phone call is that what Julian had typed in the call screener is, Falcon is a PR stunt, government is keeping us safe. And I thought you were the one person on the entire board here who was calling to tell me that I was wrong. Because as far as I can tell, everybody else is calling in to say, oh, my God. And I'm waiting for somebody to say, Tom, you've gone off the deep end, and it ain't happening. But, Barry, thank you for the call. Buck in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Buck.
Hi, Tom. I'm not going to tell you you're crazy, but I am going to say, who are these 11,000 people? Who are the 11,000 prior to this?
Yeah.
How do we even know who they are?
What happened to the 1,000 people who got rounded up after 9/11? I mean, a lot of those people are still vanished. They were flown out of the United States. We have no idea who they are, where they are. I mean,
The fact is, there's no 4th, 5th, 6th, or 8th Amendment anymore.
Yeah.
Okay? That's a fact. So if they can tell us they rounded up 10,000 felons, we don't know who they are. They didn't have to be charged. They don't have to be charged with anything. They didn't have to have warrants to go after them. They can just tell us they're these people. The other thing about your last caller, the fact is, we all know now, they had the information they needed to protect us prior to 9/11.
Right.
And this president, who is basically a dictator at this time because the Bill of Rights has been basically eliminated, this guy was at best criminally negligent of his Article 2, Section 2 responsibilities as commander-in-chief. Now,
I'm not making this up.
But
one other thing.
Mm.
The on Iraq, everybody's saying, there was just these guys were inept. There's an old saying, and maybe you can help me. I can't remember who it was who said it, but it is, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. Mm. And in my opinion, this was planned chaos in Iraq to enrich their international corporate fascist gang.
I think, I have to say, here's my personal opinion on that, Buck. I believe that they actually believed their own ideology, that they thought that if they could bring a, quote, free market, end quote, to Iraq by changing the tax structure so that there was no longer a progressive tax, but it's a straight flat 15% income tax, doing away with all the domestic content laws so that any multinational corporation could come in and do anything they wanted there, doing away with all the immigration and border security laws that have to do with who can work in Iraq so that multinational corporations could bring in workers from Sri Lanka and Pakistan and whatnot to work for pennies on the dollar or on the dinar, that if they did that they thought that it would become a paradise, because these guys have really convinced themselves of that. I think they believe their own PR.
I just have to disagree with you on that level, Tom.
Well,
I believe it was chaos. But,
yeah, I may be wrong.
By the way, if next time...
I'm sorry. Thank you. Julian in Grand Rapids. Hey, Julian.
Hi. Yes, I was listening to the story on the news at WTKC in Grand Rapids all day long, and I was panicking, wondering why no one was talking about it. And I'm really glad you did. I'm really glad you brought up the detention centers, because that's the first thing that came to my mind.
Yeah.
So, either we're all paranoid or we're all terribly sane.
Or we're all in an information vacuum. That's frankly where I'm at right now. I don't know enough to know what I know and what I don't know. And I don't mean that in the joke way, like when I have kind of, a little strange guests on and we do our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. I just don't know enough, and I don't think any of us do. Julian, thank you for the call. I got to move along. Ann in Eugene, Oregon.
Hi.
Ann, I'm sorry. We're out of time.
Okay.
We'll do it next week. We'll pick it up on Monday. Thanks so much, Ann, for calling and everybody else. Coming up on Monday's program, I'll be challenging conservative Lisa DePasquale on her statement that the left is belittling the military. And Bob Borisage is going to be here about the new Dem big lie. That and more in your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program. Don't forget to vote, because democracy begins with you, my friends. Oh, by the way, ClintCurtis.com, another great website for another great candidate for Congress who could actually win and is not getting help from the DCCC. Go help him out. ClintCurtis.com. SkinnerForCongress.com. EllenSimonForCongress.com. Tag, you're it, my friends.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.